Hey everyone, we've got an exciting new episode today. And first, a quick word about one of our sponsors. Jason Hennessy uses SEO to generate millions of dollars in results for law firms across the country. In his new book, Law Firm SEO, Jason takes you behind the scenes to see what actually works to rank on Google. Pick up a copy today of Law Firm SEO on Amazon or download it on Audible for just $25.
The court's not your friend. People think the courthouse is a popularity contest. You know, I never saw it that way. I'm there for the right result for my client. I'm not there to win friends and influence people. No, you know, the respect you're supposed to have for the bench and the mother may I, and as women, we're like, oh, this judge is, you know, it's his rules and all those feelings you have in the back of your head. I said, no, I have a client out there and that person's life is worth it. I just decided that I had nothing to lose.
Welcome to Lawful Good, a show about lawyers and the trials they face inside and outside the courtroom. I'm your host, Luke W. Russell. Today, I'm speaking with Anne Andrews. Anne is a successful mass tort lawyer. She's been involved in a wide array of product liability cases against major pharmaceutical companies like Purdue Pharma for their role in the opioid crisis. Currently, she's representing 10,000 clients against the Boy Scouts of America, which declared bankruptcy after mounting accusations of sexual abuse perpetrated by troop leaders. She's a mother, an equestrian, and one of the few women to found a prominent law firm. You can probably already tell that Anne's professional story has a lot to teach us. As I found out during the conversations you're about to hear, her personal story reveals just as much. From the gunshot that set her legal career in motion, to her equestrian upbringing that paved the way for her first mass tort. Over the course of the next hour, Anne will share with us about some of the challenges she's faced. Becoming a successful female lawyer, some ideas about how to balance the practice of law with truly living, and why we should never fail to speak out for those in need. Anne, when was the very first time you knew that you wanted to become a lawyer?
I knew I was going to be a lawyer the night my brother got shot. He was a junior in high school. I was a freshman in college. So, you know, 19 years old. And he came flying into the house and he was white as a ghost and he had blood coming down his arm and he was screaming, you know, Dale's been shot, Dale's been shot. He and his best friend, who was the quarterback of this, you know, prominent football team, had gone. They were invited over to a girl's house. And this girl was well known as inviting people over after the pizza party, after the big game, to her house for some after-hours shenanigans. And so my brother and his friend walked down the side of the house. These are large California ranch houses. So you walk down the side of the house to the back where the recreation room was, where she said, we'll have the sliding glass door will be open for you guys to come in. And this was a common occurrence. Everyone knew this girl had after-hours parties. And my brother, standing in front, behind his friend, they pulled the curtain back and were greeted with a shotgun blast. Actually, it was a utility revolver. So a gun fired from inside the house went through my brother's best friend, Dale, and grazed his arm and created a flesh wound that he was bleeding from. So I literally throw on a robe. I think we're all in nightgowns and drive to the hospital where his best friend will have been taken. He says, Dale's going to die. He was shot through the abdomen. And I get to the hospital and find the Los Angeles County Council there, badges everywhere, suits everywhere. This is like 2:30 in the morning. And come to realize that Orange County Sheriff's Department, the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department, and a bunch of lawyers are there talking to the family of this kid that's probably going to die in surgery. And these are good friends of the family. So I interrupt the meeting to say, I want to talk to Dale's parents. And they wouldn't let me talk to him. And I ended up shouting at these parents. I said, don't listen to them. I know what happened. They did nothing wrong. So I'm screaming in the hospital. our boys, the boys did nothing wrong. They were invited there. Come to find out that the man that shot them and almost killed Dale was a reserve Los Angeles sheriff.
Wow.
Who fired his revolver into two kids. Police officers, representatives of Orange County Sheriff and LA Sheriff were telling the family that they were going to charge their son, who's about to die on the operating table, with breaking and entering a felony. They told the family if they signed a release, meaning a release of all civil claims against the sheriff department, they wouldn't prosecute the boys for criminal trespass and breaking and entering a felony for which they would go to prison. And I watched that whole thing happen, screaming at the top of the lungs. I never let him talk to my brother. I think they weren't really worried about my brother because he had a flesh wound. So I pushed him off, said, "You're not talking to anybody." But the parents signed the document that night. And it changed really the way I thought of what happens in the real world. I was 19 years old.
So where did all of this take place? What was your community like as a young person?
I grew up in Fullerton, California, which is the north part of Orange County. It's about, 5 miles north of the Disneyland area, almost exactly. It's a hilly part of the county that was in the, early all orange groves and ranching. And then that part of the county was subdivided into acre parcels with a dedicated bridle trails through the whole community that preserved the ability, for horses to go everywhere, underpasses. So we commuted around the neighborhood on horses.
Oh, wow.
We often knew who was at whose house by whose horse was tied to the mailbox. It was either a bike or a horse.
Oh, my goodness.
Horses were like a primary mode of transportation as kids, galloping around.
It sounds like it's pulled out of a storybook.
It kind of was.
So as you were preparing to graduate law school, did you know what you wanted to do within the field?
I graduated in the middle of a recession, and I went to a local law school where the owners of the law school took a great interest in me and my career because they were really pushing me to do big things. They were very connected people to Reese's that own this law school. Mrs. Reese took a real shine to me, and she sat and asked me what I wanted to do. Well, I had a securities course that I just loved. So I said, I think I would really like to interview with the Department of Securities, the SEC, the commission. And so she set up an interview, and lo and behold, I was made an offer for, staff attorney. I had friends in D.C. at the time who were actually in the Carter administration, so I was pretty damn excited. And we're staying there, even though it was a transitional year. Reagan had just come into office in November, and I had the job for 2 months and I lost it. Reagan cut the Securities and Exchange Commission by 40%, cut the budget. And by the time I graduated and was taking the bar, the position was no more. I had nothing to do. I literally had no job overnight.
That must have been so frustrating. I imagine that the opportunities in a relatively rural community didn't quite match up with your ambition. So what did you end up doing?
I got a phone call from one of my girlfriends from college, another one who was in horse racing. He said, "Hey, I can get you a job at the racetrack this summer. Why don't you go on tour with me?" The racetracks are seasonal. They move from town to town in the summer. I said, "How much will it pay?" He said, "Hey, we'll have plenty of money. Our room and board is covered. You can share with me. And we drive from track to track. You'll have a blast. I'll get you a job as something on the backside paid for by the racetrack. Some sort of official, you had to be an official, a racing official." So I went on the road and I became the racetrack lawyer. Literally. Every jockey, every altercation, every problem with the stewards, and the stewards are the court at the racetrack, I became the lawyer. People bring you their problems. They bring you their tragedies, their stories, and I would help them. Bailing them out of jail if they got in a fight, on Saturday night, I would go down and, take care of it. So, the racetrack world is kind of like the carnival world. It's a closed system. They're just people in it. It's generational, and they only trust insiders, and they don't know lawyers.
So how was it that you ended up going from handling disputes at the racetrack to mass tort lawyer?
As it happened, one day, on a beautiful summer morning. We were in Fresno, California, where the racetrack goes, you know, the meet goes, it moves around the state. And it was at the Fresno County Fair. I think it was July. And there were all sorts of civic activities going on. And there, the Kiwanis Club had a hot air balloon up, and we could see it, you know, across the parking lots, and the horses are worked out and trained in the morning on the track. Well, the balloon started losing descent and failing and crashing, and it came down onto the racetrack. And the jets on a balloon are very frightening to horses, that sound, that roaring sound. So as it kind of crashed down into the racetrack, the horses just freaked and panicked, and some of them were at a full gallop. So there were horrible accidents. It bounced onto the track and then got some elevation and then crashed on top of the stable area, the barns. They destroyed over 20 horses.
Oh my gosh.
Horses are so fearful. They will die trying to get away from something they're that afraid of. Fire and sounds like that. A dozen people were terribly injured by being run down by horses or thrown off horses.
Wow.
So that was my first mass tort. Every one of those people that was hurt that day hired me, and I launched a very large, I think we had 40 plaintiff case in Fresno County against the Kiwanis for their negligence in operating the hot air balloon Kiwanis breakfast that morning.
Wow.
So that was my first mass tort.
It's really interesting how your passion for horses, you would not have been a person that should have ever been in this place if you hadn't had that interest growing up and cultivated that. And then that really opened up a door into a whole new world for you.
Well, I was not destined to go to Washington, D.C., which I thought was every lawyer's dream. I took another path.
Yeah.
I might as well have been in a VW bus at the Grateful Dead following a concert around the country. It was that time. Instead, I was following the racetrack community. You know, if you have a passion for something and it's a community, there's a million ways to get business. But being compassionate and being available and having a personality that is open and engaging with people and helping people solve problems. And you know, the funny thing about being in business for yourself is the more expansive your life is and the more things you embrace, the more interests you have, the more people you meet that need you. When I talk to young people about how to find business and how to build a reputation, I say, you have to go where lawyers aren't. We all go to these bar association meetings and we go to all the conventions and things. Well, you're not going to find any business there. That's for networking people that have the business. You have to go and find a community where you can be the smartest person there. That's a lawyer. I belong to a lot of organizations over my career, most of which were very rewarding, because it was such great exposure.
It seems like in addition to the challenges of finding work, you were also running into institutional sexism. I spoke with your longtime friend, Senator Joe Dunn of California, and when I asked him about his first impression of you, he said that you were a young female lawyer from a small firm in a heavily male-dominated world of mass torts, demanding a seat at the leadership table. Things seemed to be getting better, but even today, I think it's safe to say that there aren't a lot of women who own a prominent law firm.
Yeah, I think that's a true statement. I think the thing that I'm proud of now at this stage of my career is that I founded the firm, and I founded it early in my career, and that it's always been my firm. So some of the traditional challenges that women have with glass ceilings didn't pertain to my own infrastructure, my firm. It pertained to the outer structure, if you will. 52% of all law school students are now women. But we don't see 52% of our gender represented in any other place. We don't see it on the bench. We don't see it certainly in the traditional law firms, partnerships, women and minorities.
It sounds like you're happy with your choice early on to build your own practice. Do you think that more women should consider starting their own firms?
The power that you have by being your own boss and by having the ability to take the risk and make your practice your own, whether it's a small practice and you're just paying the rent and you're enjoying a life that, you know, is comfortable, but it's about you making decisions for yourself. I know a lot of women that, you know, have smaller general practices that make a very good living, but not, you know, they don't take on the challenges I take. They're very self-satisfied. There's something about creating your own destiny and deciding your own fate and being in charge of all that you desire and all that you aspire to is something that women have to put on their differential, if you will. I think we always think that we have to work for someone. And what I think it, I think what I'm fighting for is for women to walk into the legal field or any other field and say, I'm going to work with you, not for you. And the just the change of one word in that sentence, you know, if you're working with people and not for someone or for a firm, you're going to expand your mind to the opportunities of how to gain power inside even a large law firm.
Senator Dunn also said that you always prioritize family. Can you spend time with your family while also being competitive in your field?
Absolutely. So let's talk first about having a family. When I was a young lawyer, women didn't have children. If you wanted to be a successful female professional, there was a choice to be made, and you were judged if you had a child and you were working professional. My daughter, when she was born, I was actually getting set for trial in a case up in Monterey. Another case involving horses, by the way. See how the racetrack theme keeps coming up?
Yeah.
This was a case where a herd of horses died an unspeakable, horrible death in Salinas. When we investigated and we met with the vet and we got these hideous phone calls from the owners of this ranch crying, when horses die and they, the way in which they die, the sound they make, and people losing their livestock in real time, these owners calling me and crying, grown, hardcore, you know, very tough cowboys calling me, crying that the mares are dying and they're aborting their babies and what is going on, what's happened. Well, the vet raced out there and immediately found out that they had misdelivered cattle feed to the horses. Cattle feed has a toxic seed in it called cotton seed, and it has a chemical in it called gossypopple, which is highly toxic to horses. It's like, it would be like giving them arsenic. So they misdelivered the feed, a very large feed company, and over the course of three feedings, all it took was an evening, you know, an evening feed of the horses and this grain compiled for these mares and the babies, the livestock, and a morning feeding. And by nightfall, the second day, they were dying, just falling over dead.
Wow.
And horrible things happening to them, neurological things. So I represented a guy that wasn't very likable in Salinas, but the case was extremely provable. And about, I would say, about 8 months after my daughter was born, the depositions for that case had to be taken. And it was going to be in Monterey. So I loaded up the nanny, I loaded up the car with, you know, baby and baby supplies for a week. I set all the depositions for a hotel in Monterey for a week. I went on the record and I said, I have a child here at the hotel for today's proceedings. And throughout the week, I will be taking breaks to feed my daughter. And I plan on taking them at this time and this time and this time.
Yeah.
Thank you for your attention. And I went on the record with this. Lo and behold, they didn't want to honor it.
Oh, wow.
They refused. This witness has to go. He's only here for this time. That, you know, you can't, if you leave this room, you're banning the deposition. There's no order that allows you to leave. So can you imagine what I did? I said, fine. I brought my daughter into the deposition room and fed her.
Yeah.
To the horror of all the men in the room.
How dare you feed your child?
Let the record reflect that I'm feeding my child. I am breastfeeding my child because these men wouldn't allow me the 20 minutes I needed to go down the hall. So
wow.
I'm going to attend this deposition. That stuff happened. So my daughter was with me all the time. I raised her for the first 2 years in my office. I had the luxury. Because I was on my own boss, I had the luxury of being able to do that.
Yeah.
Not everyone can do that today. We have to change the way we allow women to raise children in the legal profession and other professions. Because like I always lecture, one of the most common questions I get asked at ECI Law School, where I've been a mentor and I've been on the board there, is by women who say, how the heck am I going to have a baby and be a lawyer? And I said, what you should be asking your question is what would let you get in the way of having a child if that's what you want? Because if all the smart women in the world stop having children because the profession is not going to allow it, or you're going to somehow receive a detriment from it, what does that say about the next generation? You're essentially telling the world that you are not going to add to the gene pool of the smartest genes because you're afraid that some male-dominated world in law is going to tell you that you should achieve less. We have to change that. There were women that told me that I shouldn't be on the PTO because I was a working mother. I went to a different school, enrolled in a different school, met a principal who was a highly educated, very gifted professional woman in the district. I went to that school and I formed the PTO. And sitting on a board, even at a law school, and screaming in my own most controlled way to a board of mostly men that they better figure out how to equal the playing field for women having children to become partners in these law firms that recruit from our school ought to be number one. Ought to be very, very high on the list of policy decisions that we apply critical thinking to and skills to and communicate to the bar.
How did your family respond to your ambitions in wanting to be a top-tier lawyer?
My dad always told me that his aspiration for me, I think he knew without saying it, bless his heart, you know, that I wasn't going to really be, in his view, really great marriage material. I was just really one of those women that was just going to tell you what I thought, no matter whether you needed to know it or not. Where my sister was much more, you know, complacent and much more, that kind of girl. I was the one that was inquisitive and bossy and always taking charge and shouting to be heard in a big family and demanding and getting my way and being I was very, very smart and very successful in academics and loved school. And my dad told me that he was really going to be proud of me when he was able to position me for the best position a woman could ever have. You're going to be an executive secretary to the vice president of Fleur Daniel, which was a huge engineering corporation,
yeah,
you know, fancy
okay.
offices, mm-hmm. think executive suite, where I had visited several times with my dad. And I was going to be his best friend's executive secretary.
Mm.
That's what he told me I was going to do.
Wow.
As I climbed the ladder of success with a bunch of other kids in the family, and he's watched me achieve the status, my father was a huge, huge lover of education. He respected it like no else. And once I was a lawyer past the bar, he kind of did, all right. Okay. You really are smart. You really did do this. Okay. So I want you to come over and pick up all the family files. I have all these patent cases I want you to look into. I immediately became the family lawyer. That was my dad.
Anne, if you're up for something that little less traditional, my daughter has a question she would like to ask you, if you don't mind me bringing her over for this.
Not at all.
My daddy tells me that it is important to stand up for myself. How can I learn to do that?
I think that knowing to trust your instincts and standing up for yourself suggests that there's a reason to stand up for yourself. And there's many ways in your young life where you could be asked to do that. For instance, you could be asked to stand up for the truth if someone was lying. You could be asked to stand up for fairness if one of your friends is being bullied or unfairly treated or improperly treated. You might need to stand up for yourself if you feel like your views or your work in school or your role in whatever you're doing is not being fairly heard or considered. Knowing that that's the right thing to do, knowing that in our culture, you'll be valued for doing it, regardless of your gender and overcoming a shyness or fear that you shouldn't. You know, I can remember times when my daughter was in school and somebody did something very naughty to her that was very inappropriate, and she was so upset she didn't want to go to school. She was afraid to tell me, and she was afraid to talk to the teacher about it because this person had done something very wrong. And I felt it when I was driving her to school, and she broke down and cried and told me. And she found, and it was somebody who she liked who was doing something very wrong to her. So even my daughter, who's very strong-willed like her mom, has had moments where she was afraid, because the penalty of sometimes doing the right thing and finding your voice scares you. But you have to believe that the grownups will be there for you, and you have to believe that your friends, you know, your immediate friends will respect you for doing it and will learn something from you. How old are you?
7.
Tell me your name, sweetie.
Lily.
Well, Lily, thank you for that question.
Thank you, Princess.
That was very brave of you just to be able to get on camera and ask a question. See, you spoke up.
Thank you, Anne. How far were you into your career before people understood the value that you bring to the table?
Well, you know, there's a smile on my face because I think I made about every mistake you could make, you know, in the world of litigating mass torts before I was accepted or advanced. But my grace in doing, in making them and fixing them, and then always volunteering for important projects, always staying present, attending every meeting, never missing an opportunity to give my opinion, and then finding a role in a case that I was particularly good at. One of the challenges of being a lawyer in this setting is that every case requires a new skill set. You know, I had to learn the science of addiction and the science of recovery for the opioid litigation. You know, the challenges now are I'm having to learn how to represent people who are horribly sexually abused. And that's required a completely different skill set in the Boy Scout bankruptcy, where we represent 10,000 clients. I became an expert in cardiovascular issues because I took my law firm on a journey to sue dietary supplement companies that made dangerous products with stimulants in them that caused heart attacks and strokes. So I became an expert on the cardiovascular and the electrophysiological issues of the heart, what they call rhythm disturbances caused by sympathomimetics. So every case has its challenge, and you have to be able to adjust your game to where the case is taking you. And I think that's a problem for a lot of lawyers. You know, if you can understand the science behind why a drug is going to cause what it's going to cause, you can convey it to a jury through the experts.
You mentioned the importance of experts. What kind of role do you think they should play in mass tort cases like yours?
A lot of lawyers believe the stories told through them, and that opening statement and the plaintiff themselves and the drama of case that really impacts a jury is told by, let's just say, the biased people, the lawyers, their clients, their family. And what I always felt was that the real people who brought juries in the most complex, high-profile cases in the country were through the true, unbiased opinions of experts. That they were the ones that spoke most first to a judge and then secondly to a jury. So if you could bring the true world opinion leaders on a subject to a judge, first of all, they were always hella impressed. You know, to think that you know, a professor from Harvard who has a practice of, you know, saving lives every day is sitting in a court, that case that day was that important to that doctor that he or she flew all the way to that trial in order to tell the judge the story and the jury the story of what happened in this case and why a Vioxx drug caused it, that impresses the heck out of the judge and then the jury.
When we come back, we'll be hearing from Anne about how she balances the need to be an effective team player with fighting to get her clients the justice they deserve. Stay with us. I'm Luke W. Russell, and you're listening to Lawful Good. Hey everyone, Luke here. If you're thinking, hey, these interviews are unique and really highlight the humanity of the guests, that's because this is what we do all day, every day. I own an agency, and we work with law firms who are marketing and advertising for mass torts and personal injury claims. We drive results by using the power of human stories. Our unique and thoughtful methods for crafting messages allow us to help lawyers get clients by connecting with the hearts and minds of potential claimants. If you're looking to serve more individuals in need of legal help and you want to get away from generic marketing, shoot me an email at luke@russellmedia.us. That's luke@russellmedia.us. And we can set up a time to chat. Or if you just want to give me a ring, ping me on my cell. It's 317-855-8597. And if you're thinking, wait, is that normal to leave a phone number in a podcast? Maybe not. But hey, look, I have been in this industry for a long time, and I know a lot of great people in it. So you can reach out to me at 317-855-8597. We left off with Anne sharing her views of how to harness the power and authority of quality experts in order to make her case to the judge and jury. She believes it's the unbiased opinions of experts that help her get justice for her clients. I'm curious, what do you think underlies, or maybe what is it about maybe your mindset or maybe a lack of ego that led you to say, hey, me winning this case isn't about me. It's about getting the best experts in the room.
Even though I have a very strong personality, I also knew to be successful in the way in which I wanted to work in the law, I had to be a team player. And if you interviewed all the people who I sit on committees with now and have sat on PECs with and done work with, they'd say, yeah, Anne is very opinionated and she always speaks her mind. And she's very, very clear that she will be heard, but she's mostly right. I'm fair. I would like to think that all the employees, all the attorneys and staff that work for me, I think they think I'm fair, but I'm a tough taskmaster. But in doing so, always, they know how much I care about our clients, and they know how important it is for me to be successful for clients.
Would you say you're a difficult person to work with?
Yes, I would. I mean, difficult in the sense that I have very high standards and a lot of shouting goes on in the beginning of a relationship of a case to overcome the deafness. And, you know, I guess if I had anything to say about my ego, maybe it's not more about, you know, winning a trial that drives my ego. It's more about having my position be heard and being right and knowing that people will accept that I'm right. And then being a team player, knowing that I'm part of a team that puts on a trial and I kind of enjoy the collaborative. I was a musician at one point in my life where I sang in music ensembles. I was a trained classical musician. So I think ensemble music taught me a lot about how to work with people. And if I was assigned a solo, as I often was, stepping out on the footlights and then claiming my solo role was great fun. But then stepping back into the ensemble was, you know, the way you do in choruses was always easy for me. And I enjoyed it a great deal.
It seems like a lot of your success has been driven by persistence and determination. Can you think of a time when that spirit of persistence was really challenged? Or a time when you just felt like it was difficult to continue?
I had a writ practice for a long time. So you have to figure out a way as a young lawyer to both take risk cases and then take pay cases, right? So my writ practice as a young lawyer also grew out of the racetrack, where the stewards at a racetrack would rule on regulation that a trainer or an owner or a jockey was suspended for a violation of the rules of horse racing, right? Never had a full hearing, no due process. They just make a ruling, they issue it. It's basically a small tribunal. So all the jockeys, owners, and trainers would come running to me when they'd get a ruling. And I always tell them, they call, I said, you will lose, but race to my office, have a check ready for this amount, and I will get to court with a writ in 24 hours to overturn it and to get you back and to get your license, because the license is like a driver's license. So if you have, you know, 20 horses at a racetrack being cared for every day and you don't have a license to run them, your operation is in trouble pretty fast. So they would come to my office and I would prepare, these were called writs of mandamus, to overturn a court. Well, back in the day, there was one judge in the writs department. So I appeared in front of that same judge every time I filed a writ. And that judge in one particular court in downtown Los Angeles, so it was a better experience, had a better track record, no pun intended. That judge got so mad at my writ practice that he would refuse to come and take the bench and face me for argument. He would sit in his chambers and just write denied and send it out with the court.
Wow.
So you know what I did? Because I have a client standing there waiting to have their business reinstated. And a judge says denied. And they're expecting me to stand up and advocate for them and want to see that their rights and their access to justice was granted, even for 5 minutes. So this judge and I had a notorious experience where I stood at the clerk's desk with the bailiff watching me. I was also threatened with contempt more than once. I said, I am not leaving this courtroom until Judge so-and-so comes out and I'm allowed to argue this writ. I will not accept this. I'm entitled to a hearing. My client is here. And if you don't allow this, I'm going to report this to the presiding judge. So over the years, as I was president of the local bar association, that judge became an appellate justice. And I would see him at gatherings, you know, Senator Dunn had the entire bench at his house all the time, you know, because he was always very involved in judicial politics and the funding of the courts. And so we had a lot of fundraisers. So I would always be in the company of this judge that must have denied me like 20 or 30 writs over 2 years. Denied. So I found him. I found myself in his company and he says, gosh, you know, you look familiar. Do I know you? Because he's a very haughty, you know, appellate court justice now. I said, as a matter of fact, Judge, you do. He says, how do I know you? I said, I hold the record of having the most writs denied in your courthouse of any lawyer in the history of Orange County. I hold that record today and I own it. And I told this judge in front of a lot of other justices, I said, you know, a very smart jurist told me one time when I kept saying, I have a hard time getting in to hear judges. I have a hard time getting them to listen to me. He told me, sometimes you just have to keep knocking on the doors of justice to be heard and never stop knocking until you are. And in that writ practice, they would close the court, literally wouldn't open it.
Wow.
And then I would literally be knocking on the door to be let in for my 1:30 hearing when he would just say, oh, there's a writ on for this afternoon. I'm not even opening the court.
Wow.
So I've always said, you know, the doors of justice aren't always open. You may have to knock and keep knocking and bang and beat them down. It takes a lot of training as a trial lawyer to understand the court's not your friend. You're not making friends. People think the courthouse is a popularity contest. You know, I never saw it that way. I'm there for the right result for my client. I'm not there to win friends and influence people. Now, I happen to have a lot of friends who are judges because I was in a leadership position and interact with the bar. But I didn't go about trying to, you know, make points with the bench. I mean, you have to have a judge on your side if you can get them there. But if you can't, you have to fight with them to be sure the record's clear and to be sure that your arguments are heard regardless of what they think of them if they're wrong. And I just decided that I had nothing to lose. No, you know, the respect you're supposed to have for the bench and the mother may I and his women were like, oh, this judge is, you know, it's his rules and he doesn't, you know, like me and I'm not popular and all those feelings you have in the back of your head. I said, no, I have a client out there. And that man's life has been ended by a kangaroo court that suspended a license. And I have to get it reinstated to get a trial, to get a due process hearing. The law requires it. And that person's life is worth it.
I'm hearing a lot of compassion from you toward the people that you represent. It sounds like you spend a lot of time with your clients. Is that common for someone in your role?
I don't know that a lot of people in a senior management position in a law firm really talk to as many clients as I do. You know, we're getting ready for some pretty heavy duty trial work in the Boy Scout case. it's emotionally draining. It's a challenge to be able to talk to people who have to describe to you unspeakable acts of suffering and humility and assault and pain and what they've been through. And I worry about my staff and my attorneys, and I'm constantly checking in with them. Because if your whole life was spent, your whole professional career is spent talking to people who are victims of horrible abuse, like so many other kinds of trauma, it affects your work, and it becomes too much to bear to take on all that suffering from a human being. And, you know, we've had some real tragedies. A team of lawyers was on a call interviewing a young Boy Scout survivor, a boy who was abused at a young age, seriously, horribly sexually abused, along with his brother. And during the interview, a family member called informing our client that his brother had committed suicide. And my whole team, my whole firm just sort of fell into, you know, desolation. But, you know, that takes you to a very scary place, that life is so fragile and that you're really interacting with people at a level that is life and death for some. So we kind of gathered up everybody emotionally in our firm's arms, and we got counseling and we sat and talked with people. And that's the part that I have to stay in touch with. I traveled to Massachusetts several years ago to meet a woman who I much admire and who is a client and who founded a support group for parents who have lost a child to opioid overdose, to addiction and opioid overdose. And these were soldiers. We have a Gold Star mom. These were students. These were college athletes. These were policemen. Their children were valuable members of society. And
yeah.
I sat with each member of the group and cried with them. I mean, you can't not as a parent, you know, I have children, and I couldn't as a parent not take their grief and feel what they must feel like every day, not having that child that I have in my life every day. No one cared about opioid addicts when I started that project. No one cared about the suffering of the people who were addicted by Purdue and other companies with an intentional scheme. No one cared about them. No one spoke for them. Everyone spoke for the governments, you know, the Indian tribes, all of the municipalities and insurance companies were there. And, you know, nobody was speaking for the victims, the people who actually were damaged by these drugs. And knowing that they were raising money and going out and having bake sales and doing 5Ks and getting sponsors to raise money to bury children, because these families did not have the money to bury a child who was lost an overdose. Just meeting people and having them in your life, a long life's journey like that, what a rich reward. I'm talking to them in the most human way and representing the world's forgotten people. The Boy Scouts of America didn't want to know that there were 80 some thousand men who were abused over 40 years. They still don't accept it. And they're attacking me. They're calling me names in court. That's fine. I've heard it before. They're attacking my clients. They're calling them names, frauds. So, you know, I represent those people, you know, that's life-changing. It's not just what gets you up in the morning. It's what gets you to stay late at night and work on the weekends and make you feel like every minute you're spending in this world of these people doing what you know in your heart is right, that they don't have a voice. And as Mike Papatonio and other, you know, great lawyers would say, giving a voice to the voiceless.
I imagine some of our listeners might be hearing you and thinking, wow, Anne, she is an extraordinary woman. I wish I could be like her, but I don't have it in me. What would you say to that person?
I didn't think I had it in me. I just did it. And to the people who have doubt, you know, you put one foot in front of the other, you have good days, you have bad days. Listen, you know, everybody talks about all the cases they won. You want to talk about the cases I lost? You know, picking myself up off the ground, like literally for 2 weeks, feeling like I had a horse sitting on my chest and couldn't get up. The pain of loss was so hard on me. And, you know, I'm the person that could lose the unlosable case. Because I did. You know, I mean, the courtroom and the jury system is precious, but it's also extremely unpredictable and volatile.
Yeah.
Overcoming doubt it was hard for me. I look back at my career when I was just starting out. I didn't know I was going to pay the bills or keep the lights on. I just did it. And I think what we talked about earlier, knowing that I could never work for someone, I could never give that power to a male-dominated structure and a male-dominated law firm that was never going to give me the power back. No matter how many times I tried to get the power back, I knew never working for another firm, for another infrastructure that was male-dominated, always being able to self-determine. And then, you know, finding a way to finance my own cases. I mean, that's a whole nother course that we need to teach women how to find financing and how to take risk and things that they believe in.
And how do you take care of yourself as you're bearing all of these stories? And I hear you talking about taking care of your staff. How does Anne take care of Anne?
You know, she probably doesn't do as good a job sometimes as she should. I have a terrific partner. My partner, Sean Higgins, can run this firm, and I can go away and think, not a problem. I think that's very important that you have people that you can trust and rely upon to go and relax, and that they're saying, I got this, and you can believe it every minute of every day. It's funny, the things I don't do. I'm not a golfer. I guess I'm more of a naturalist. I enjoy nature. I hike a great deal. I have gangs of friends that, you know, we crawl around the various parks and mountain areas. I'm a big fan of national parks. Don't tell anyone, but one of the best relaxation, quiet places in the world that no one goes to is Death Valley, because there's no one there, because tourists don't want to go anywhere that starts with death in its name. So sure. It's so far off the grid, and it's so relaxing and otherworldly. There's so many beautiful things to see in the desert, and we're going there for several days. We usually make a couple trips to Europe a year. I manage to play really hard even while I work. So one of my favorite things about New York, when it's operating normally, I'm a huge theater fan and a huge opera fan and a huge just walker. So I promise myself, unless there's rain or really bad conditions, I'm always walking. I'm never in an Uber. I'm never in public transportation. I walk everywhere. And my daughter was a theater kid, so we have a lot of friends in theater now. So I'm often following careers. So we see a ton of theater. Big fan and patron of the opera. So everybody knows in New York when there's a meeting, it's got to stop at 6:15 because Anne's running across Times Square to put her, you know, fanny in a seat at some fabulous show, or she's running up to Lincoln Center, and that's non-negotiable. I am out on my way, and it's every night I'm in New York. Every night. I do not miss a thing. And I find that the arts takes you away from the law and gives you the sense of a bigger side of yourself and a community and an experience that, you know, soothes the heart, challenges the brain. I go to very emotional things. I'm not just a happy-go-lucky kind of art consumer. I go to what my daughter and I call ugly criers, you know, who we're going to some really serious play or music drama tonight. It's going to be an ugly cry night. I've always had horses, and when you're riding a horse, you cannot, it's impossible to force yourself to think about anything else, but how that, no matter what your level of experience is, and I'm not a very proficient dressage rider, but I do challenge myself. You cannot think about anything else. You are literally away from every other stressful or complicated thought when you're guiding a very large animal through a series of challenging maneuvers that may be beyond your ability. I've gone to Spain, and I've traveled in foreign countries to places where you can have these equestrian experiences with great horses, other riders, other trainers, and sort of the horse community, the equestrian community is a really tight-knit one where I'm friends with people all over the world who I've met at various programs where I've sharpened my skills in a certain area.
I feel like, for me at least, it's
romanticize this idea of being able to ride a horse and just hearing you describe, you know, like you can't think about anything else and you're going, I'm imagining going across fields and up and down hills. It sounds amazing. And I'm venturing a guess, there's probably a few hundred hours required to get to a place where I might even be able to halfway do that. Is that probably accurate?
You know, it kind of depends on the person. I mean, you can start out with the lessons at a local riding stable. There are lots of places where you can, you know, learn how to get your seat. It's harder than driving a car because you're right. You know, it's a living thing, but it's sort of like, you know, it took you a while to get used to driving a car, right? Some yeah. people are better drivers than others, but, you know, I think people find it so rewarding because the animals are so compelling. There's a reason why horses are featured in art. They're featured in therapy. They're featured in romance. You know, what commercial haven't we seen recently where the gorgeous white horses of Remarque are running across the beach in France? Those are wild white horses. We have the wild Mustangs in Nevada. You know, horses are magical creatures that communicate with humans very well. And that connection has been shown to be very important in therapy with children and with ill people. They bring a lot of compassion to your thinking and the sensitivity of them. You know, there's some great courses where you don't even have to ride a horse. You can go and learn. You can have an emotional journey, an emotional experience. There's a great trainer up in the Santa Barbara area, North Santa Barbara, named Monty Roberts, who puts on a clinic where all you do is interact with the horse and learn how to use its energy to move it.
Oh, wow.
So some people just really love the interaction of understanding a horse's energy and how to move it without touching it. And it's, you know, it's the horse whisperer kind of approach to training horses. I've gone to those clinics. I've watched people engage in them. And a lot of really emotional work comes out of it. People who are traumatized or there for reasons. It's very healing. Those clinics are fascinating, and there are a lot of places in the country where you can have an experience with an animal in the horse world that isn't what you think of as just, you know, get on and ride around the plane, but you know, that you can do it in stages, however you like.
Yeah. Do you own horses this day?
I do.
How many and what are, names and breeds?
I have two Arabians, Polish Arabians, Allure and Masada. However, they are very senior citizen, statesmen, retired, super champion show horses. The horses, when they're really well cared for and when they, you know, and Arabians in particular can live a very long life, I'm happy to report they're healthy and they, although we're not, you know, driving them into the bit and charging around on them as much, they get exercised and enjoy. You know, they're in their 90s in horse years, but they're loving life and they're very dear. And they put a lot of years in carrying myself and other people around the show circle, the show ring, being champions, and they're enjoying a terrific life. I would like to add to my equestrian family. I also love horse racing, and I may or may not be investing in a few shares of fractional ownership with Spendthrift Farms. So there's nothing, everyone has to have a team. I'm not a sports fan. I love sports when I'm watching them in person, but I'm not somebody that's going to watch baseball games and basketball games every Friday night for, you know, 85 nights out of my life. But when there's horse racing going on, I'm all about it. And owning a fractional share of, you know, a string of horses. And I'm doing this with a girlfriend who's very proficient, whose family's been horse racing forever. So we're kind of doing it as a girls club kind of thing. So we'll follow them and keep it sane. Horse racing is for the most part for the very, very, very wealthy, mostly people from other countries, mostly people from the Middle East these days. But owning a fractional share in a spendthrift, you know, investment is a fun way for, you know, everybody could do that and have great fun. We go to the Breeders' Cup every year, which is 2 days of basically the Olympics of horse racing, 2 days every year.
Okay. And it's your 80th birthday celebration. People from all throughout your life are present.
These are great questions. Yes.
A gentle clinking on glass can be heard, and a hush washes over the room. People raise their glasses to toast to you. What are three things you want them to say about you?
She fought for people who deserved justice when no one else would. She fought for her gender when no one else could. And she's lived a life that, not by accident, but by the strength of her character and convictions, meant a lot to many people. And we were honored to know her.
Thank you, Anne.
To learn more about Anne's law firm and the litigations that she's currently involved with, visit andrewsthornton.com. Thanks so much for listening to us this week. This podcast was produced by Kirsten Stock, developed in collaboration with Max T. Russell, edited by Kendall Perkinson, and mastered by Guido Bertolini. A special thanks to the companies that make this project possible: X Social Media, Russell Media, and the SEO Police. You can learn more about these groups by visiting our website, www.lawfulgoodpodcast.com. I'm Luke W. Russell, and you've been listening to Lawful Good.